This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 26, 2011. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, May 26 will come to order.
If done right.
The first item on our agenda is a correction and approval of minutes. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to approve Agenda Document 11-27, minutes for the open session held on May 5th, 2011.
Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Motion carries 6-0. The next item on our agenda is the policy regarding disclosure of documents and information in the enforcement process. This matter was held over from our previous meeting. There are late submitted documents on this item. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Yes, thank you. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 11-23C, 11-23D, 11-26, 11-25, 11-25A, and finally, 11-24A.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries 6-0. As I mentioned, this item was discussed at our last open meeting. It was held over to today to provide some opportunity for public comment. As you note from the new two late submitted documents, there are revisions to each of the proposals that were put forth at the last meeting. And I'll turn it over to my colleagues for any discussion on drafts. Vice Chair Hunter.
I'd like to begin by moving one of the documents, and then we can talk about it after that. But I think we've had this discussion, as you pointed out last week, and agenda document 11-23C is similar to the one we discussed actually 2 or 3 weeks ago with some revisions. So I'd like to move to adopt agenda document number 11-23-C.
Is there any discussion on the motion, Commissioner Weintraub?
I think Commissioner Walther wants to speak on the document. I don't want to preclude him from doing that, but I would actually like to ask my colleague to hold off on that motion because there's another document that I would like to make a motion on, and I'm expecting it won't win, but I can't make my motion if you've already made your motion. You know what I'm saying? Because your motion's going to win, I'm guessing. Not to give away the ending to anybody, but it's...
I didn't realize that to be the case. I thought you could still move on it even after the vote on this, but if that's not correct, then...
Well, it would be an odd motion to make afterwards, to move...
Sure.
Once something has
been
said.
Yeah, I just think procedurally it would be odd.
Okay, then I will withdraw my motion for the time being at the request of my colleague.
Thank you. I didn't want to talk.
Well, thank you. I'd like to just speak on the one motion that's been withdrawn. This is the same motion, same document that was before us, except that there's a few changes that have been made. And rather than go through the substance, which everybody knows pretty well, I'd like to say that actually the comment period was helpful because what it did is it cleansed our thinking, mine for sure, on exactly how the Department of Justice wants to articulate our relationship for purposes of something like this. So the draft 1123C incorporates that verbatim twice. I felt that it was pretty clear before because it was misunderstood, and maybe I'll take a minute and go through it. It was misunderstood as to whether or not the commission would have any discretion to override an agreement, any aspect of the law, any part of our regulations. That was never suggested in that draft. The question really involved a procedure by which it could come before the commission to decide that question. Rather than leave it solely with the Office of General Counsel in a case like that. So, I mean, it wasn't as if there'd be any discretion that they could override the law, but merely make the decision as to whether or not it did or didn't. And that would be the final decision would be with the commission on something that important. And, I mean, we can look at it in the reverse, and the office might decide that it didn't override that, and we could go ahead and do it, where the commission may have a different point of view on that. And, I think it put the responsibility where I thought it really belonged. When it came to something, it was a close call. So that is one of the major changes that occurred, and I think it's important to have it in there. There is a couple of other things. And footnote 57 is an addition, which it points out, in any instance in which the Office of General Counsel has concerns that disclosure of information pursuant to the procedure would lead to a result that is materially inconsistent with either the Commission's administrative responsibilities or with the promotion of fairness and efficiency in the Commission's enforcement process, the Office of General Counsel may seek formal guidance from the Commission on how it should proceed. So in this case, if we're breaking new ground, there's some concerns about it, not that it adds to the power of the Office of General Counsel to do that, because I think any time there's a problem with an issue of note, the Office of General Counsel can come to the Commission for guidance, but this was a way to alleviate any concerns that somehow there would be a loss of discretion by the Office of General Counsel to bring these issues before the Commission in cases of lack of clarity in a given situation as to how this would apply or otherwise. And other than that, I think that most of the changes that were made are self-explanatory. And I'd be glad to answer any further questions.
Any other discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I also think that the extra time was beneficial and that the document is better today. I'm still not going to be able to support it, but it is better today than it was 2 weeks ago, and I appreciate the changes that have been made. There is one question that I would like to ask my colleagues. The document states that in cases that involve multiple respondents, if we're going to give information to one respondent that concerns another one, that the respondent receiving such documents may be required to sign a non-disclosure agreement to keep confidential any document or information it obtains from the Commission. Given that we have an obligation to keep this information confidential, at least during the pendency of the investigation, why would we not routinely require people to sign non-disclosure agreements if they're going to get access to information that would otherwise the agency would have to keep confidential?
Well, I think it's important to point out this isn't, I don't think, really breaking any new ground. We have the same issues that have been confronted for 30 years when we have correspondence, and it doesn't intend to expand on the right of any correspondent to get greater amount of information. But what it does is it just makes clear that we can, in a given case, if it seems appropriate, and it would just depend entirely on who the correspondents were and where we were in the investigation, that procedure is available to agree to a non-disclosure agreement if the other correspondent wants to waive any confidentiality provision that may exist. It's something that you're correct. I think we should do it whenever we think it's appropriate to do it, regardless of this policy.
Well, my point is that I think we probably ought to be doing it as a matter of course. It ought to be. I think that is one change that really would make this an even stronger document. And I, you know, ask my colleagues to consider doing that, just to say that while there may be instances where it might not be warranted and the Commission might choose to say, no, we don't need it in this case, I would think that we would want the default to be, as a matter of course, we're going to ask people to sign these non-disclosure agreements. That's, you know, I'm not going to vote for this document, so I can't really propose to amend it, but I suggest to my colleagues that I think that would be a better idea.
Let me address that again. In the instance in where you'd have a non-disclosure agreement, it would only be probably in a case where another correspondent said, okay, I'll waive it, you can use it, but I want so-and-so to sign a non-disclosure agreement. But if somebody waives it and they don't care, then it's not of note to us. So I think that's one of the issues that would be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I don't think it would be necessary every time, but it's certainly a way to maybe ameliorate concerns of a correspondent if they did waive it in a given case.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I hear that. But I believe the policy also provides for the Commission to provide documents in certain instances, even if we don't get a waiver from. Maybe I've missed some change along the way, but that's my understanding of it. So I think that there could be a situation where we don't even have a confidentiality waiver, and we would be doing that. So
I don't review this as saying anything like that. that if we have an obligation to keep something confidential, that we on our own would vote to breach that confidentiality.
But the policy does say that the council will bring to the commission if we don't have a confidentiality waiver, you know, and the policy would otherwise require us to disclose those documents, then yes. The commission could override that.
But I think what I'm, again, want to point out is if we have a confidentiality situation in a major case, and, you know, I can't think of one except possibly one that we've had where commission attention to that issue could have been given earlier. But if we have a situation where we aren't sure whether we need a confidentiality waiver or not, that can come to the commission for a decision. Not that the commission can say breach the confidentiality, it's just that the responsibility for deciding that gets up to the commission level.
Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you. I hear you. I see I'm not going to win on this argument. As I said, I think that the document has been improved, and I appreciate that. I still can't support it. I would support, and that's why I asked Commissioner Hunter, Vice Chair Hunter, to hold off on making her motion. I would support Agenda Document 1123D, which I think is a policy that conforms more closely, was modeled closely on the FERC policy and conforms more closely to the policies that are in use at other administrative agencies. It's hard to find an administrative agency that is actually analogous to us, because most enforcement agencies can actually levy fines, and we actually can't, except in the case of administrative fines. We have to negotiate with people. We have to get them to agree to pay fines, to agree to take remedial actions, to agree sometimes to acknowledge that they have violated the law. Sometimes people don't want to do that, but it's all a negotiation. We then have the option of going to court if people are unwilling to enter into conciliation, but that, of course, requires another four votes, and it's never been the default position. It's never been something that is done routinely around here, and it certainly is done a lot less now than it used to. So we have limited enforcement powers to begin with. We're really, you know, have to do this sometimes with one hand tied behind our back. And it's my experience, having represented respondents and having served on this commission, that in almost every case, the respondents know more than we do. And I think that the both policies would provide exculpatory and mitigating evidence. The policy that is more likely to be adopted would provide all documents in the file that are relevant and non-privileged, and would provide them at an earlier point when we enter into conciliation, which is often a very early point. Sometimes we don't even do an investigation. We just go straight into conciliation. If we were only dealing with individual respondents at all times, it would be a lot simpler. But frequently, we are dealing with multiple respondents. And that raises the confidentiality issues. And I'm still not entirely comfortable with us having a routine practice of asking people to waive a protection that was written into the law by Congress, that they're entitled to this confidentiality. And I'm not sure that waiver solves all problems, particularly when not coupled with a non-disclosure agreement. When you have multiple respondents, there's two possibilities. One is they could be adverse to each other, and one is they could all be, you know, together on it, and sometimes even represented by the same lawyer. So even having the non-disclosure agreement would raise interesting issues in the case of multiple respondents who are all represented by the same counsel, you know, who obviously would see the documents at an earlier point. Often we deal with, you know, sort of the lesser culpable people first, and then we build our way up to the more culpable parties. You know, I'm going to have to reconsider that strategy in the future if it's going to mean authorizing the release of documents before we've completed investigations against the folks who might be most culpable in the violations, because even with non-disclosure agreements, sometimes people lie to us. And so they're not a perfect protection, but as I said, when you've got them all represented by the same lawyer, it presents an interesting question of how non-disclosed it really is. Not that the lawyer would disclose something that he wasn't supposed to disclose, but it would might inform the advice that he was giving his other clients. And when you have parties who are adverse to each other, then I think we will find ourselves in a situation at some point where somebody's going to get burned by this, where the parties are adverse. And I know respondents' lawyers out there probably think, hey, this is a great idea. I'm going to get a lot of documents, and I'm going to get them early, and I love that idea. But one of these days, somebody who's in litigation with somebody else, and they're both respondents, is going to find his documents shared with somebody that he doesn't want them shared with, and they're going to be burned by it and come back and say, hey, what about my confidentiality? And I think that this will happen. The other problem is whether this will undermine our ability to build cases and to go after the most culpable parties in these multiple respondent cases. I think it does create the opportunity for collusion. I'm not saying it will happen, but you know, I think that the opportunity is out there when we start sharing our investigative documents at an earlier stage before we've completed the investigation into all parties. And as I said, you know, our tools in investigation in enforcement are somewhat limited to begin with. Congress set us up that way. And we are you know, the notion that we are a fierce investigative agency that people are quaking in their boots about, I think, is probably not the case. If it ever was, it certainly is not today. You know, if we recently got a briefing from our staff on status of enforcement, the number of cases we've been considering, you know, if you look back FY07 through FY10, last completed fiscal year, the number of cases that we've considered has remained relatively constant at about 145. We had a blip up in 08. There were a little bit more. But the number of conciliations, the number of respondents that we've conciliated with as a result of the matters that are before us has actually quite precipitously declined. So in FY07, we negotiated conciliation agreements with 91 respondents, and by FY10, we were down to 29, about a third. And that's a pretty sharp drop, I think. Because, of course, you need four votes to enter into conciliation with parties. If you look at probable cause findings, that has also precipitously declined. It's never been a routine matter, but we had 12 cases that went to probable cause in FY07 and two in 10. And going to court, of course, happens even less frequently because people settle after that. If you look at the amounts of the penalties that we've been able to negotiate with folks over the last few years, FY06, actually, I'll go back another year, the average was close to 180,000 was the average penalty that we got in a MER. In an FY10, it was down to $42,000, less than a quarter of that amount. So, you know, by roughly any measure of how many conciliation agreements where how many respondents were conciliating with, the amount of the penalties, we are a less aggressive agency than we were a few years ago. And I think that this will make it actually even harder for us to be an effective enforcement agency. Back in 06, 07, they said we were feckless and toothless. I'm not sure what the adjective would be today. But I think that we could protect respondents' rights. I mean, both of the documents acknowledge this. The Brady line of cases only applies to criminal cases. We as a civil agency aren't even obliged to go that far, but we want to. You know, we all agree that we should, and a number of administrative agencies do. And I think that's the appropriate place to tailor our policy at the Brady line of cases and at the and to give the information out at the probable cause phase, and that would protect both the rights of respondents and protect our ability to aggressively enforce the law as appropriate. So, I guess with all of that, I would like to move that we adopt agenda document number 11-23D.
Any further discussion on this document? Commissioner Walther?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, in isolation, wouldn't oppose that, but so I just want to say that I'm glad that, you know, really we're in sync in some important areas, and like that on Brady for the most part. I think it's important for us now to formalize that. But I think what we need to do is look at a couple of things besides just what helps somebody's case, if we're going to give them information. Most lawyers who represent clients want to know what hurts their case, and I think that's where we need to give some guidance to. It has to do with all aspects of that. I think my record shows I'm as strong on enforcement as anybody here on the commission. I think what's important to me is to make sure when we do it fairly. What we're doing here is talking about a fair procedure that occurs after we've already voted RTB. So I don't think it should, you know, reduce the number of votes, you know, the number of cases that come before us. What it does do, though, is provide that there is more transparency to counsel, you know, during the various stages.
My name is on this draft, so it won't surprise anyone that I'll be supporting this one. I agree with Commissioner Weintraub that I think there's been some important changes to both drafts to reflect some of the things that Commissioner Walther was talking about with respect to our obligations when it comes to information we receive from other law enforcement agencies. The two areas I think of sort of main distinction is the timing of when we are releasing this information, and there appears to be unanimous consent that at the probable cause stage, that turning over exculpatory evidence is important. So there is some, I think, universal agreement amongst commissioners as to some aspects of this, and there are obviously other areas of distinction. One of the parts of the proposal that Commissioner Weintraub and I have put forward is a pilot program. I think that's particularly important in this area is to, and it's something that we have done in almost all of the other procedural initiatives that this commission has taken in the last few years, to give us a chance to evaluate how something new is working for respondents and for the commission. And I think that would that's an important aspect that I would have hoped we could have gotten into the policy that's likely going to be adopted today. I think this is a significant change for us. I think all of these issues about waivers and non-disclosure agreements and how the sort of appeals, if you will, process works of the request coming to the commission. The commission, unfortunately, doesn't always answer some of these questions when they come to us in a quick way. We may decide, you know, we may find that this is not as expeditious as we would have hoped it would be, and that this is actually just delaying an enforcement process that I've heard many say already takes too long. So I would have hoped we could have taken an opportunity to assess this at some point in the future and adopted this as a pilot rather than an ongoing program. Obviously, the commission can revisit any of its policies at any time, but as we all know, sort of the ongoing day-to-day business, AOs are always coming in the door. We always have new complaints filed. The election cycle is starting up again for the next cycle. We have a lot of work to do on a day-to-day basis, and sometimes it's very difficult for us to get back to rethinking an existing policy. And I think that's a part of it that is very important to me. Commissioner Walther.
Yeah, thanks very much. And one further comment on that. What this does propose in response to the request for consideration of a pilot project, I think one of the frustrations for me has been during this, since I've been on the commission, is I'm not aware of any pilot project that actually got voted in after it was adopted.
No.
I'm talking about if we have a pilot program. They seem to remain a pilot program. And I think for the most part, the way I'd like to do is make sure this stays the policy. We get an annual review from the Office of General Counsel every year. They can tell us if we think there's issues to be improved, if we're going awry in some way, and keep it on track. But I think it's an important policy to keep in place, and so it's a way to have a constructive discussion on the impact of this on an annual basis and see if we want to make some changes or cleanup or amendments or whatever we want to do. On the other issue of timing, I recognize that there's some concern about having this be operative during the pre-probable cause stage, but that's an election that the commission decides. They decide when they want to get into pre-probable cause, and at that point, if they think that the status of investigation is an issue, they can be taken into consideration at that point.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a note that the probable cause hearing started out as a pilot program. It was a pilot for about 8 or 9 months, and then we adopted it as a permanent program. So we have actually made permanent some of our pilot programs.
Any further discussion on the motion to adopt 1123D? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails 2-4. Is there any further discussion or any other motions? I believe there's one that was withdrawn.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt agenda document number 11-23-C.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion carries 4-2. Thank you very much to counsel for your input in this process. And we'll move on to our next advisory opinion on our agenda, Democracy Engine LLC, Democracy Engine Inc. PAC, Mr. Jonathan Zucker and Mr. Eric Pennebaker, represented by Mr. Gold, who is with us today and available to answer any questions should the commission have any. We will hear from Ms. Hayden of the General Counsel's Office when she's ready.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly, and good morning, Commissioners. I'd like to note, I think there's a late submitted document in this.
We did a mass motion at the beginning of the meeting, and I believe we covered it. Thank you.
Great.
The Secretary's nodding at me, so thank you, Ms.
Thank you. Before you is agenda document 11-26, which responds to an advisory opinion request from Democracy Engine LLC, Democracy Engine Inc. PAC, Mr. Jonathan Zucker, and Mr. Eric Pennebaker. Democracy Engine LLC is a for-profit limited liability company offering a web-based payment service that provides individuals with the ability to make contributions to federal political committees for a convenience fee. Mr. Zucker and Mr. Pennebaker are members of the restricted class of Democracy Engine Inc., PAC's connected organization, and intend to use Democracy Engine LLC's services to make contributions to Democracy Engine Inc., PAC, and other political committees. The request asks 3 questions about the contribution processing activities provided by Democracy Engine LLC. The draft advisory opinion concludes that, 1, the activities proposed by Democracy Engine LLC will not result in an impermissible corporate in-kind contribution to any political committee. 2, the payment of the convenience fee by a contributor will not constitute a contribution by that contributor to the recipient political committee. And 3, because the payment of the convenience fee will not constitute a contribution by the contributor, Democracy Engine Inc. PAC does not need to report such payment to the commission. We received no comments on either the advisory opinion request or the draft, and I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hayden. Is there any discussion by the commissioners or questions for either general counsel or the counsel for the requester? Is there a motion? Vice Chair Hunter.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move to approve agenda document number 11-26.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Motion carries 6-0.
Go on.
Thank you, Ms. Hayden. The next item on our agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2011-07, Chuck Fleischman for Congress, Inc. Mr. Randall Herbert, the treasurer, had requested to appear by phone today. Unfortunately, we are told that the Verizon landline phones in Washington, D.C. are actually down, so we are not able to conference him into the meeting today. We have been in contact with him, and he is he understands the situation, and he has relayed to us that unless commissioners have questions for him, he is fine with us proceeding with his advisory opinion today. Mr. Stepanovic, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly. Good morning, commissioners. Agenda documents 1125 and 1125A respond to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of the Chuck Fleischman for Congress, Inc., the principal campaign committee of Representative Fleischman. The committee asks whether it may use campaign funds to pay legal fees and expenses of Mr. Saltzman, a consultant to Representative Fleischman's campaign during the 2010 primary and general elections in Tennessee's 3rd Congressional District. The legal fees arose from a civil suit filed against Mr. Saltzman by a former campaign staffer over Representative Fleischman's opponent in a 2010 Republican Party primary election. There are three drafts before you. Draft A concludes that a committee may not use campaign funds to pay Mr. Saltzman's legal fees and expenses because such payment would constitute personal use under the Act and Commission regulations. Draft B and revised Draft B, on the other hand, conclude that a committee may use campaign funds to pay these legal fees and expenses because such payment would not constitute personal use. The Commission did not receive any comments on the advisory opinion request or on the advisory opinion draft. I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any discussion amongst commissioners? Commissioner Walter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I'll be the lone vote, but I would move draft A.
Any discussion on that motion? All those.
I would just like to say I would move draft A because in this particular case it seems like the relationship was that of a consultant, and it was sufficiently isolated so that really it could not come back to the campaign for a claim of liability, which of course the campaign's not been sued, but then it has the claim is now made that there's a sufficient nexus to pay for the legal fees, and so I just think we're moving too far to the point where we're paying legal fees or fees or obligations that the campaign doesn't have. And when I read the irrespective test, it applies, as I see it, to expenses that are not of the campaign, not of a third party. So in any event, I move draft A.
Any discussion on adoption of draft A? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion fails 1-5. Is there any other discussion or motions? Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of agenda document number 11-25-A, which is revised draft B.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that I'm going to be supporting this motion. I think that the campaign consultant was doing work for the campaign and is being sued for work that he was doing for the campaign, and that's why I think it is not personal use for the campaign to pay his legal fees.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Yep. I recant there. I did.
The motion carries 5-1. Commissioner Walther dissenting. Thank you, Council. The next matter on our agenda is an audit, the proposed final audit report on the Kansas Republican Party, AO8-2. Mr. Stoltz and Mr. Bonowitz, please proceed when ready.
As I think everybody knows, the report was circulated and there have been some suggested edits. We've looked at the edits, we're fine with them. So other than that, we're ready to answer questions.
Does anyone have any questions or discussion on the audit? Is there a motion? Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to approve agenda document number 11-24-A.
Any discussion on the motion? I wanted to note, I'm supporting the motion, obviously. We were able to make just a few edits. This process of drafting audit reports has been changing over the past year, and we've worked through, I think, a way that commissioners are all comfortable in how we describe the commission conclusion section, particularly when there aren't four votes for all of the recommended findings. And so this additional issues section is fairly new to our reports, but I think this is one where we've now been through the whole process under this newer procedure. And so the substance of this audit was determined at our meeting in March. This document reflects the decisions of the commission at that point in time. And based on that, just those decisions, the final audit report does not include the disbursements regarding the national convention. That is an area that the commission disagrees on. Commissioner Walther and Weintraub and I voted for the findings proposed by the audit division that did address the federal funds issues related to the national convention and a few other items. So there's no need to rehash those discussions. Those decisions were made by the commission in March, but those do appear in additional issues because there was not agreement among the commission to put those into the findings that had been recommended. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Before we adjourn our meeting, Commissioner Weintraub wanted to take a moment of personal privilege.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sad day in the FEC. We are losing our ethics lawyer. I have asked Ethan to come up here. He's obviously dressed in his packing clothes today. Didn't know he was going to be called into the hearing room, but I could not let this moment pass as a former ethics lawyer myself without saying how mad I am at you, Ethan, for leaving. You know, I guess he's getting married and he wants to live in the same city as his fiance. So, okay, I don't want to stand in the way of romance, but really, Ethan is about as fine an ethics lawyer as I have ever encountered in my career, and I've known many. And it's hard to find somebody who has that level of expertise and also can make it all fun and entertaining and interesting to people. I mean, I always find it interesting, but I know not everybody does. But Ethan's got a really great way of explaining and training people on this, and we are really going to miss him. So this is his last day in the building. This is kind of a quick exit for him, but we wish him well. I know everybody joins me in wishing him well and thanking him for his excellent service. Ethan is, I should mention, so well-regarded in his field that he was recommended by a group of ethics lawyers to have a detail to the White House, to their ethics office, which they only do for their most esteemed colleagues. And he is our esteemed colleague. And if you ever get tired of New York and you want to come back here, you give us a call, Ethan. And in any event, if you ever need a job reference, you can always call me. So thank you for your service.
And I think all the commissioners join Commissioner Weintraub's sentiment in thanking you for your service as we all go through some of the requirements of related to ethics that we as commissioners have to. I know I have, and I'm sure others have, relied on your advice and counsel. So thank you very much. Are there any administrative matters, Mr. Palmer?
Madam Chair, there are none.
Thank you. Our meeting is adjourned.